Well, thanks for joining us, everyone. We've got Scott Mayer, Senior President of Technology Planning Engineering for AT&T. A lot going on at AT&T right now, and we're going to touch on probably both wireline and wireless technology. I think you need to read a safe harbor. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to flip the chart here. Okay. So a message from all my legal friends back home, our safe harbor statement. So before we start, I'm going to just cover this. Today's comments may contain forward-looking statements. They're subjects to risks and uncertainties, and results may differ materially. So if you need more information, you can find it in our SEC filings or on our website. And then the other thing, Mike, is I just wanted to mention, we got the 600 auction in progress with the SEC, so I'm not going to be speaking about that at all today.
We were hoping to get actual dollar amounts.
Well,
most
sorry.
Unfortunate. So maybe you could just talk in broad strokes the strategy that you guys are engaged in right now. We can cross over between wireless and wireline. DirecTV, obviously, is a big feature if you guys are integrating and getting synergies. And how do we think about, I guess, from a technology standpoint, the wireless network and the wireline network as you sort of integrate the DirecTV asset and what the challenges are there?
Sure. So when you look at the wireless network, that obviously is a really good capability for us. But with the DirecTV deal, is what we're doing is we're using both a broadband play, if you will, for delivery of video as well as satellite, and rotating more towards satellite, and then using the wireless network for over-the-top type technology is what we've announced and discussed in our plans around some capability there. So we think it's a set of assets that is really, really strong for us. And when you look at the wireless network and the capability that we've built out there, the network is really, really strong. We've seen huge growth on that network, 150,000% over the last 8 or 9 years from 2007 through 2015. And that's not going to stop. When you look at how people are using the network today, it will continue. The good news is it's really strong, but it's a consistent strong. Right? We're not seeing step functions. We have good capabilities in place to handle that growth. We're seeing, an architect in the industry, analysts would say that we're going to see 10x the volume over the next 5 years, and we believe that's probably the case. And so we're architecting and designing our strategies and capabilities to handle that kind of growth.
So maybe just thinking about what we'll call the future home, moving beyond set-top boxes and, obviously capacity needs, but how does that look for AT&T on a going-forward basis? DirecTV content clearly being delivered, but probably on different platforms.
Yeah, so as we look at the platforms that we have today, we'll be integrating those platforms over a period of time. And then also as you look at the way that video is being delivered even today through over the top and through applications, there's going to be more and more, I think, application or video player type capability that will get integrated into TV sets and other appliances in homes. So it's not necessarily going to be what we've seen today, but we see that evolving to include more and more software-driven capability and an integrated capability on a platform basis.
And how do we think about the AT&T footprint? You've got a pretty big wireline footprint. Within that, Gigapower, legacy DSL in some cases. Mm-hmm. Out of that region, wireless, so how do we think about your delivery mechanisms for video as you progress over the next 3 to 5 years?
So when you look at the wireline footprint that we have today, really dense, good fiber environment, we're building that out with even more FTTP. So we have about 1.6 million customers today that can get up to a 1 gigabit per second service from us. That's in 21 markets. So we'll be moving that to almost doubling, in fact, more than doubling that this year to 56 markets. So we're continuing to build out a really, really good, strong fiber footprint. And what that does is when we deploy fiber, we're doing it on an integrated basis from a planning perspective, right? And that's the value of what assets we have today is we're bringing pieces together from what do I need from wireline, wireless, and business as I deploy that fiber. So that fiber footprint that we have also helps our future cell deployment, small cell deployment, capabilities that I think we're in a really good advantageous position for. So when you look at the wireless capability out of footprint, we have a really good strong fiber base today to our current cell towers. We do that through a set of different solutions. We'll continue to, on a periodic or a very more specific basis, deploy fiber out of region. That's been our strategy. We're continuing on that strategy. And we believe that the wireless technology is a good delivery mechanism for higher and higher speeds as we look forward to the next technology.
When you say deploy fiber out of region, what does that look like? Is that cell backhaul or is that something else?
So it's cell backhaul as well as in certain places for businesses. So we've been following that strategy. We have assets out of region today. And we continue to deploy fiber out of region where it makes good economic sense. At the end of the day, right, we're all building on a set of economics from an engineering standpoint, we'll continue that approach.
So I guess that leads into a topic, 5G. You're thinking about out of region fiber assets. Maybe there's more assets that you'd like to have. But as you think about 5G deployments, you know, is it something that you guys want to do on a widespread basis? Is it too early to be talking about this? And then maybe as you look at the different spectrum bands, is it really only set up, we don't have standards yet obviously, but is it really set up for that ultra high frequency spectrum, or can you actually deploy it on other bands as well?
Yeah, so I'll just kind of, there's a few questions there. Let me just talk about 5G in general. The path that we're on right now is we start from the position of strength. Back 4 or 5 years ago, we started our VIP project, intensifying the network. That's going to serve us well going forward. We also have, as I mentioned, just the fiber footprint. So when we look at 5G, we start from a position of strength. Timing-wise, just I'll talk a little bit about standards and how I think it unfolds over time. Phase one standards are due to be delivered in September of 18. So phase one standards covers what I think is the first use case, which is enhanced broadband wireless. And so there's two variations of that. There's a fixed wireless solution and then truly a mobile solution. And so those standards are going to come out in 18. The other two use cases that we see will come about a year later, I think probably by late 19. Release 16. Those two use cases are massive IoT, where we need really, really high densities, like a million IoT devices within 1 square kilometer type capability. So we need to re-architect some of the LTE architecture to support that in 5G. And the other use case is what we call basically low latency, high reliability use cases, vehicle to vehicle, as well as medical devices, smart cities, those types of things where we're going to need less than 1 millisecond on the air interface. And so that's the standards. Typically what we see from a commercial production or deployment standpoint is it's about a year after the standards come out. So that's what we're going to see. But between here and then, here's what I think is going to happen. There's going to be a lot of labs work going on, a lot of labs testing, lots of proof of concepts. There's going to be some level of field deployments going on as well as everybody's learning in this space. And that's, I know Verizon has announced what they plan to do, you know, by end of year 17 with some pre-standards gear. We will be doing the same. We expect that we'll be doing some field level involvement with pre-standards gear by end of year 17. It's the way that you learn, right? And there's always a risk with putting some pre-standard stuff out there, but it's the best path forward for us and actually for the industry, because what you learn then gets plowed back into the standards bodies. And so I think everybody's going to be on that learning curve. And we haven't been sitting still on 5G. We've been doing a lot of work in the labs ourselves. We have our Austin trial that we've announced in partnership with Ericsson and Intel. This summer, we'll be testing 15 gigahertz fixed wireless configuration. By end of year, we'll be going to 28 gigahertz in a fixed wireless configuration. And then actually in early 17, we'll be rotating into that mobility use case. So that's a set of testing that's going to be going on. And we've also got a lot of patents filed on millimeter wave and network virtual functional network virtualization, if you will. If you look at the key ingredients for 5G, background technology,
the spectrum piece. So these pieces of spectrum that you already own.
Yes.
And I guess the broader topic I think that people like to talk about is whether or not this can be deployed on lower band spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, when you look at 5G, the actual technology will use millimeter wave, but will also use other spectrum bands. You know, the type of the bands deployed today, as well as there's the 3.5 that's coming is more Wi-Fi based. So it will be eligible or possible to be using all those spectrum bands. So, in fact, when you look at how you architect it, you might use one band in a certain way with 5G and some of the higher frequency millimeter wave bands to I'll call it complement it.
Yes, but without getting too technical, it seems like that higher band spectrum, the propagation characteristics are not very good. What do the economics look like? Is this simply dense urban market rollout? I think the analogy was, I can throw a football across the room further than this signal travels. I mean, it seems to me, having covered the industry for a long time, that economically doesn't make a lot of sense, but your comment would be great.
Yeah, so, when we look at what we're doing with small cells, right, we've always viewed small cells as a solution set amongst the other ones out there, right? Macro, small cells, DAS for in-building, sector splits. We use all three. What we do is we actually engineer for a cost per gigabyte, right? How do we deliver a cost per gigabyte in the most efficient manner? And so when you look at that, in any particular situation, one of those solutions is going to be the best answer. What we see with small cells is the use cases, if you will. The first use case, in fact, you even mentioned it, Mike, is that initially it's going to be dense urban core, urban, some suburban areas, and that's where the use cases probably make a lot more economic sense for small cell deployment. So we'll see that. When we look at what we see the trends are, we're going to be doing more small cells in the network than we have historically. We'll actually see small cell spending go up. As a part of it. But when you look at our overall CapEx, that doesn't imply that the CapEx is going up because you're providing capacity one way or another. And we think there's a good economic solution when you get the right set of circumstances to use small cell technology. So small cells are a precursor to actually being able to use millimeter wave. So as we deploy small cells, it's pre-positioning us for further densification in those areas, and also the millimeter wave technology. So that's the roadmap as we see it playing out. And we think, again, the fiber assets we have, will really help because part of it is the backhaul cost associated with small cells. And we're starting from a really good dense urban grid. So if you have a really good dense urban coverage, you can actually use small cells to augment it and have a very, very good solution set.
Thinking about that, there's been a lot of discussion in the industry about tower spend. I think John Donovan's been pretty vocal on his side. As you think about small cell build-outs in these dense urban markets, how important is that, the macro network? And then maybe just a comment on whether or not Wi-Fi is a suitable enough substitute. I live in Manhattan. They actually just rolled out these NYC Link boxes all over the street. I'm actually getting 400 meg down across most of the city streets. It just seems like that's a very simple, elegant solution, and we can talk about security and safety and people snooping, but in the end, the consumer probably doesn't care.
Yeah, so as you look at the, I'll just speak to Wi-Fi first.
Sure.
So as you look at Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi itself is actually a very good solution that carries a lot of traffic today. In fact, when you look at wireless devices, 80% of the traffic that emanates from a wireless device is carried on Wi-Fi today. And so it's a key part of the solution set. I don't think it's necessarily a substitute for the macro network. Why? When you look at Wi-Fi, it's not necessarily architected for the elegant handoffs that we see in the wireless networks of today. And so it has some limitations associated with it, but it's a key part of it. And so now when you look at we just released voice over Wi-Fi. So that voice product is actually a really good enhancement to our capability. And so the same thing, it's going real well for us. We see growing traffic on it. but it's not a replacement, you know, for a voice just on Wi-Fi. It augments the macro network, and we've been really pleased with the performance. So the technology works, but when you get into the handoff issues and the consistency of experience, that's where I think we'll struggle at least at this point.
Yeah, I've suffered from handoff issues constantly, but
yeah, it's part of the technology at this point.
Sure. So I guess, you know, along those lines, thinking about the macro network, you've got a very strong, robust network, but thinking outside of the dense urban market, how do you sort of think about tower costs? Is there savings to be had there? And as you talk to tower companies on a going forward basis, deploying new spectrum, maybe you could just touch on your thoughts on timing of WCS deployments.
Okay.
And industry as well.
Okay, so when you look at the actual tower costs, right, they're a key element and a key part of our cost structure. So as I mentioned, we engineer looking at cost per gigabyte, and tower costs get added into that. One of the things that, as a business, we always look at, you know, our cost trends, and we look at you know, areas that we need to focus on. You know, towers, the tower component of the business is a key part. So, you know, like anything, we'd always look at, you know, what are the right actions for us to take? How can we manage that cost per gigabyte? And what's the business model, you know, that we need? So, you know, we're always talking and looking for solutions and different business models that help us. And this would be no different at this point in time. So on the second part of that, WCS, and the timing of that, we started in 2015. By the end of this year, we'll see several thousand sites in AT&T's network with WCS. So we're beginning that deployment. And like we started in 15 and got...
I'm sorry, just to frame that, several thousand sites, is that a lot?
So it's a small percent of our overall network at this point in time, but we're ramping it. We deploy spectrum using basically a capacity trigger, right? When we need to deploy capacity, we look at the right approach and right solution set. And WCS is the next band that we want to put into service, and so we're putting it into service to help us, you know, drive that capacity curve, you know, up. So
given the propagation of WCS, I'm presuming that's going to be in the more dense urban markets?
Yeah, we'll use it where we think it's the right answer. We're starting in more of the dense and urban suburban areas. That's logically where the capacity triggers come first. So that's going to drive that. You know, less so in the rural and less dense areas, absolutely. AWS-3, again, as we have said in the past, even after the auction, we think late 17 just to, you know, get familiar with it and get start to ramp, but we won't see any sort of volumes, I think, until 2018 of any significance. So that's kind of the way the roadmap lays out right now.
So can you talk about, you know, we touched on DirecTV earlier, but from a network standpoint, I guess both wireline and wireless, what challenges does DirecTV introduce to you? And thinking about the 4Q launch of DirecTV now, it seems like it's going to put potentially strains on these networks as things move off, you know, broadcast television into IP-delivered streams.
Yeah. So where I started a little bit earlier, you know, we always have a strong growth. I mean, we have for years, and our forecasting process assumes that there's a lot of growth that we're going to see in the future. And so what we do is we architect the network to be able to handle that. The good news about being an integrated company now is we actually know what that forecast looks like and had been assuming, you know, some level of traffic. And we're well prepared to handle that traffic, not just in the short term, but in the long term, and are very comfortable with what we're seeing. So between the AWS-3 and WCS spectrum and, you know, 40 megahertz of that, we're repurposing spectrum, you know, from 3G even today. So we're repurposing 3G. We've announced our 2G shutdown at the end of the year. And so, again, that's going to free up more spectrum for us to use in the network. So there's a lot of solution sets and a lot of assets that we can bring to bear to manage that cost curve.
So I guess, you know, thinking about, I know you've been engaged previously on Project VIP. I think there are a number of, I'll call them vendors of yours, that thought that was not a temporary situation, and frankly, I think investors may have thought it wasn't temporary either. And yet we've seen that spending coming down. As you think about rolling out Gigapower, which is part of the deal with DirecTV, How far does that go? When you think about the cost, to the best you can tell us, sort of cost to connect, cost per home passed, how do we think about gigapower on a going forward basis?
Yeah, so where we're at right now is, as I mentioned, 1.6 going to 12.5 this year. The good news about the gigapower build is it extends what we've done before in terms of capability. So we built an IP broadband network and an IP video network using largely the same processes and technologies. The FTTP version of that is just getting that last few hundred feet with fiber. And so it's not a stretch for us. We know how to build disaggregated and distributed networks and know how to do it well and have lots of practice at it. And as a result of that practice and experience, we're really good at the cost curves and the process and the cost efficiencies. And we like what we're seeing right now with gigapower and the cost points we see. We've got a lot of experience to build from. We're not starting from scratch. And I think the economics are looking like we expected them to. There's no surprises there. And are pleased that...
So we're not going to see VIP 2, I assume.
I would not expect so, at least on a, you could look like that with a different change.
So you talked earlier about wireless capacity. How do we think about that? AT&T had a pretty well-known issue, I suppose, in San Fran and New York a couple of years back, and you've rectified that, and the network, I think, is probably as strong as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
How do we think about capacity utilization, whether it's backhaul, spectrum? I'm sure you have a heat map of some kind that you're looking at, but
mm-hmm.
what are the measurement tools that you guys use?
Yeah, so I'll start with the forecast process, which we've got a really good, hardened, and pretty robust and sophisticated forecast process that was learned the hard way, to your point. And you don't want to ever get caught by surprise, and that process is paying us dividends at this point in time. We watch the forecast and the actuals religiously. I'm on calls on weekly and monthly basis. We see any trend that changes, even a little trend. And as I said, that's why it gives me, with high confidence, I can say it's a pretty consistent trend. There's not step functions. And if there's something that goes on, someone releases a new app, you might see it, but you have to look really close because of the scale that we're running at. It's not a step function. And so those processes really have helped us anticipate what's coming down in the future. The other thing is that as we look at the scale that we're running at, we can't use the same old plays that we've been using. We have to virtualize, and that's what's driving us into virtualization of our infrastructure at this point in time. It allows us to scale quicker with a really good cost structure, and when you look at where we're doing that first, right, one of the areas is we're doing it in the mobility data core. Right? I mean, we actually implemented last year a virtualized platform that's now got 14 million customers on it in the mobility core, and we'll continue to virtualize areas of aggregated traffic as an opportunity. And so we're doing the same thing with voice. So we launched Volten, and that's going to be running. We're starting in 16 and 17. We'll virtualize that capability in the core, and not just for Volte, but for all of our voice products. Single platform, wireline and wireless voice products, including Volte. So that virtualization is the way that we're going to scale with a good set of economics and stay ahead of the curve.
So I guess that is a good lead into something that AT&T has been talking a lot about, software-defined network. Many of us that are not technologists by trade have no idea what that means. Can you just sort of explain at a ground level what it is that you're doing on that front? And then as we look at from an investor standpoint, what are the milestones or KPIs that we would look at? Is it a margin story or is there something else to it?
Yeah, so I'll start with just a real simple what is it? Because the way I'll describe it is the network is built up of a series of functions. And what we're doing is we're taking those functions from hardware and custom software to just virtualizing it, just software. Those functions equate it to the alphabet. So if you had 26 letters and you had 26 different functions, those letters then get stitched together. So they're building blocks, if you will. They don't mean a whole lot unto their own, but as you start to stitch them together, letters become words, and then you orchestrate words into sentences and paragraphs. And so now if you start to virtualize the functions in a network, and we've said we're going to virtualize 200 different functions, you now then can begin to stitch those together, or the term in the technology term is orchestrate those into products and services in a way that scales, that allows you to add feature functionality faster than you ever could before, and gives you a good cost curve because you're running it on commodity hardware. So think about the alphabet and functions and the way that then you architect solutions and services. So where are we at? The first two instantiations, the first two product sets, if you will, that we put into the marketplace are great examples of what we're going to see. Network NetBond is one, so a lot of our cloud providers have signed up for that. Allows a customer to, through an interface, establish a secure connection right into the cloud infrastructure itself, all the way to the actual server. And it gives them security and peace of mind that, you know, they can interact with their application and software without a problem. Second one is network on demand, and that one is a collection of virtualized functions that allows a customer to really manage their service the way they want to. They can scale up speeds on Ethernet links. They can deploy firewalls and load balancers and all these other things on a portal in minutes. And so, again, that is stitching those functions together in a way that you can create a customer service. So we'll see it in terms of the cost structure change and the ability to scale. Key metrics for us, and we've been public about it, is what percent of your network is virtualized. And so we said goal last year of 5%. We hit that. We said this year, in a lot of work, 30% of our functions are going to be virtualized. And so we're on a roadmap, and the more we do that, the more we get on commodity hardware, the more the cost structure is better off for us, and also our ability to scale and handle the load. So I think it's going to be embedded and inherent in the actual cost that you see, you know, in our reported earnings and how you look at the business on a cost per gigabyte or however the models might be built. It is the way that we're going to architect the future.
Great. I think we're out of time, but I'd like to, if anyone in the audience has a quick last question.
Do you want me
to? I don't see any hands. Oh, you got one? I'm sorry.
Just to dovetail that, I get the cost structure change and the virtualization, but how about a way to monetize that? Are there these products generating enhanced revenues given the ease of use for the customers to ramp up and down? What's the impact on the top line?
Yeah, so the monetization is really in being able to sell into customer bases you haven't been able to sell into. Plus, the more they like it, the more they actually will buy. And then also, as you add software and feature functionality, so you can go up the stack, and you can do that relatively easy or easier than continuing to deploy hardware and software, unique appliances, if you will, to do it. So speed, convenience, customer experience, and having a feature-rich set that fills the needs of our customers is the way that we'll continue to monetize that and grow that revenue base.
I think we're out of time. Thanks,
right.
Scott.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.